The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
A vaccine passport's a passport to tyranny. Why I'm not crying over George Floyd. And Parkland parent Andrew Pollack comes aboard to talk about gun control. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Conservatives and Republicans are in an uproar over the Biden administration's plan to develop vaccine passports. Now, the idea of a vaccine passport is, related to the idea of a passport itself. A passport gives you permission to do things. It gives you permission to go places. It gives you permission to enter. And without a passport, you can't. Now, most Americans, interestingly enough, don't have passports. Why? Because this is a free country. You should be able to move around and travel in the country and do business and go on vacation without somebody asking you to, quote, produce your papers. That's almost something that you see in third world countries, tyrannical countries, countries where sort of authentication is a prerequisite to being able to even function normally in your ordinary life. By and large, we haven't had to do that in this country. Now, very interestingly, the people who are pushing vaccine passports for Americans are the same people who don't want voter ID. These are the same people who don't want identification and proper procedures at the border. So they're loose with the border and they're loose with voting, but evidently they want all Americans to show proof of vaccination in the form of this kind of either government issued or government coordinated passport. Now, for me, the idea of a vaccine passport brings up some sort of chilling historical parallels. When I was filming Death of a Nation a couple of years ago, I was in Germany, in Munich, and there's this huge Platz. It's called the Odeon Platz. Four gigantic lions. I'll put up a little clip in a moment so you can see. This was a major Nazi checkpoint. Take a look. So this is just an image here of these four lions, and the Nazis used this as a spot, a kind of central location, to check everybody. And of course, they had special mechanisms for checking the Jews. They wanted the Jews to be identified so they could then be segregated into ghettos, their rights denied, and so on. So this is the historical backdrop of this notion of marking, identifying, tattooing, and you may say passporting citizens, not traveling between one country and another, but within the country itself. I think the reason that Americans are concerned and even outraged about this is it is such a preposterous overreaction to the COVID situation as it is now. Think about it. The risk of dying from COVID today in pretty much any age group, and this is without being vaccinated, is essentially less than 1%. It is infinitesimal. You have a 99% chance of survival, and that's without being vaccinated. Now, let's imagine a situation where somebody is not vaccinated and they want to travel on an airplane or they want to go into a store. Now, first of all, no one is saying that private companies, like a private store, couldn't say, hey, listen, you have to wear a mask if you come into our store. But if you can show proof of vaccination of any form, then you don't have to wear a mask. We're not objecting to the private sector taking individual decisions of this kind. What we're objecting to is sort of the government's idea that, hey, if you don't have a vaccine passport, you shouldn't be able to do normal things. And I say, why not? Why shouldn't you be able to do normal things? You might say, well, that's because you have a risk of transmitting the disease to someone else. Yeah, but if vaccines are widely available, and if every American is free to take and get a vaccine, what's there to complain about? There might be people who are exposed, but they're the people who have chosen not to take the vaccine. They're willing to take that risk. Why should the government step in and protect them from their own choices? It's very clear that this vaccine passport is a mechanism of social control. Here's a guy named Harry Littman. He's an editor of the LA Times. He kind of spells out the rationale. He goes, vaccine passports are a good idea. Among other things, it will single out the still large contingent of people who refuse vaccines, who will be foreclosed from doing a lot of things their peers can do. That should help break the resistance down. So this is what we're getting into. The idea of trying to strong-arm people and bully them, cajole them. It's not enough to tell them what the risks are and let them exercise their freedom responsibly. The idea here is to make them. This COVID epidemic has been politicized from day one. It's been politicized in a way by the Democrats, but it's been politicized also by the CDC, by the World Health Organization. So part of the reason we're so resistant to all these measures is we don't trust the establishment. We don't trust these institutions. We don't trust the government. Quite frankly, if Trump had been reelected and Trump said, hey, listen, I've just got this idea for a vaccine passport. It's not going to be a government-run thing. But essentially, the basic idea here is that it essentially frees you from other types of restrictions like mask requirements and so on. Most people would have said, well, yeah, that's probably fine. So what I'm getting at here is I think that a lot of the anxiety about the vaccine passport is who's doing it. We're living at a time where we don't trust basic institutions. We don't trust academia. Why? Because it's indoctrination. We don't trust the media. Why? Because it's not news. It's ideologically spun opinion. We don't trust Hollywood. We don't trust the FBI. Why? Because they're not meting out equal justice under the law. This is politically motivated prosecutions. And so for the same reason, we don't trust the Biden administration. Why? Because a vaccine passport for them isn't just about the vaccine. It isn't just about protecting you. It's ultimately a form of social control. Sleep is something we all do every day, and it's really important for our health. I sleep better when I have the right pillow, the right sheets, and the right pajamas. I love wearing Mike Lindell's pajamas. Well, not his pajamas, the My Pillow pajamas, and they go very well with Mike's Giza Dream Sheets. The team at MyPillow is very grateful to you. They have an amazing offer. Buy one, get one on their incredible sheet sets. Mike Lindell has come out with the world's most comfortable bed sheets. He found the best cotton in the world in a region where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bed sheets are made with this long staple cotton. Mike guarantees, and I guarantee, they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors. Like all of Mike's products, they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Right now, you can buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. The Derek Chauvin trial is underway in the killing of George Floyd. And opening statements have been spoken, and now the witnesses are starting to come forward. We're beginning to get a sense of how this trial might play out. And of course, around the trial, there's also all kinds of theatrics going on. On a somewhat menacing side, it's almost like the left is organizing a sort of potential insurrection. They're pulling together all these warnings and all these groups that say, hey, listen, if this goes the wrong way, we're ready to launch a riot. Very dangerous atmosphere. The courtroom itself is fortified to prevent this kind of thing, this kind of mood from infiltrating the courtroom itself. But it's hardly impossible to be aware of it occurring right outside. There's also elements of comedy. Reverend Al Sharpton is in town. Where else would he be? This is like America's number one race hustler. And for him, it's all about the theatrics. Apparently, he decided to, this is mostly for the cameras, to take a knee himself for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. He had some guy press his knee into his, and he's mimicking George Floyd. I mean, if he wanted to go the whole hog, he should have, done a home invasion and shot himself up with fentanyl and done those sorts of things. Apparently, he didn't do all that. That was too much. So he decided just to do the last part of the play. And of course, it's all to get media attention for himself. This is kind of his business. He's in the race business. It's proven a highly profitable one for him. That's why he wears really nice suits, travels by private plane. He's a race entrepreneur, Al Sharpton. But let's turn to the trial itself, because I think that we're beginning to see the outlines of the defense of Chauvin. And it's very interesting because the Chauvin defense is tied to the defense of all the other guys. There were other cops involved here. And interestingly, the prosecution has basically accused those guys, one of them, by the way, Asian American, one of them a Latino, of being part of this conspiracy, if you will, or assisting, aiding and abetting Chauvin in his murder of George Floyd. So what I mean is that this is kind of a pyramid case. If Chauvin gets off, then the other guys get off. They get off almost automatically because Chauvin is the main perpetrator. Now, what is the defense for Chauvin? First, he's going to make the argument that Floyd was shot up on drugs. This was initially denied in the media at the beginning of the case, but it turns out that Floyd himself admitted that he was, quote, hooping, which is to say, taking drugs. Second of all, there was a large amount of fentanyl in his system, and apparently quite enough to cause his death. In other words, he had four times what is considered to be a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. Now, true, Floyd said that he couldn't breathe when the knee was on his neck. But that's not the only time he said he couldn't breathe. He was saying he couldn't breathe from the beginning. So long before the cops did anything to him, Floyd was like, I can't breathe, suggesting that the asphyxiation that he was experiencing had nothing to do or wasn't directly related to the knee on his neck per se, but might have preceded that, might have been actually an effect of the drugs in his system. Now, when you turn to the other officers around Chauvin, their role is actually quite ambiguous. In some cases, well, one of them, when Floyd said to the other guy, this is a guy named Lane, Floyd said, hey, don't shoot me, man. Lane goes, hey, I'm not shooting you, man. So in other words, you see the cop kind of working with Floyd here. And Floyd is at one point struggling to not get in the police car. He's like, I won't get in. I can't breathe. And Lane says, listen, I'll sit down with you. Lane rolls down the windows. Lane offers to turn on the air conditioning. In other words, Lane is trying to help Floyd get in the car and experience no discomfort. So all of this is a way of saying that this is not that easy of a case. This is not that easy of a case also because they'll be looking at the police manuals and they'll be looking at the fact of whether or not this form of restraint, which admittedly to the rest of us looking at it, it seems horrific. It seems that there's no justification for doing it. But what if it is, in fact, something that police officers are trained to do? Well, that would suggest change the manual, but you can't really send Chauvin to prison for 10 years or 20 years or the rest of his life because he did something that the police manual, in effect, told him to do. So I say all this because the media is giving you a sense that this is a clear-cut case. It's a clear-cut case of murder of some sort. But when you begin to think about it, was it murder in the first degree? Did Schumann intend, deliberately premeditate, plan to kill Floyd? No. Number two, was it a crime of passion? Did Chauvin sort of lose it and go nuts? No, it's not that either. Now, one of the charges is murder in the third degree, but even then, when you begin to actually read what needs to be proven, you have to do, quote, an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life. So this is really the heart of the matter. The prosecution has to prove that Chauvin acted in such a manner that he showed no regard for the life of George Floyd. The jury is in a precarious position. A couple of jurors had to be let go because they said they were terrified for their life. They didn't think that they could bring themselves to convict. They were in fear for their families. So this is the environment, not a healthy environment, not, you may say, a judicious environment, hardly an impartial environment for this kind of trial to be going on. And yet it's precisely obligatory for societies like ours that prize ourselves on upholding the law and innocent until proven guilty and presumed innocent and an impartial jury to make sure that what drives this case is the requirements of the law and of fairness and not the antics of Al Sharpton or the baying mob on the outside. Do you think our nation's economy is going to be insulated from Biden's planned massive tax increases? Think again. There's only one way to protect your savings. Do what over 10,000 other smart investors have and convert a portion of your retirement accounts into gold and silver with Birch Gold. When inflation hits, and it will, gold and silver are your safe haven. And Birch Gold Group is the company I trust to help you convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. Through April 30th on qualifying purchases, when you buy physical gold or silver or open a precious metals IRA with Birch Gold, they will send you a free home safe. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRA or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, they can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free safe with qualifying purchase. I don't know if you've seen the quite disturbing and shocking video of an Uber driver, a fellow named Muhammad Anwar, who was killed in Washington, D.C. This guy was driving and two young girls, teenagers, tried to rob him, ages 15 and 17. And when he began to resist, they tasered him. He drove the car away. The car crashed. It turned over. And the guy was killed. A horrific incident. And yet, what strikes me, and I'm saying this because I'm watching this on social media at the same time I'm following some of the developments in the George Floyd trial, the Derek Chauvin trial, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, there's almost no media coverage, no comparable media coverage of this. The circumstances seem kind of similar. You've got a person of color, in this case, a Pakistani, I believe, immigrant. By the way, he has three kids. He has four grandkids. He's a family man. He's murdered in horrific circumstances, just doing his job. But here's the key. He's murdered by two black teenagers. And so, once again, all murders that don't fit the narrative of a white perpetrator or a white cop and a black victim become media non-entities, become ho-hums, become kind of ignored. In fact, what's kind of weird is that I'm seeing all kinds of efforts on the part of CNN and then recently Juan Williams and Fox News to minimize the murder of Muhammad Anwar. CNN called it, quote, an accident. As if they sort of I guess they just meant to taser him and steal his car, and then they used too much force, and so they killed him. And Juan Williams on Fox News was saying that these girls were, quote, looking to have a joyride. Really? If you're going to have a joyride, do you carry a taser with you? If you don't intend to use violence and force to immobilize the person whose car you're trying to take. So I'm not saying that they meant to kill him. They probably would have preferred to immobilize him and just take his car. But they killed him in the act of doing that. And that is murder. Now, contrast the situation of Anwar with George Floyd. In George Floyd's case, you have a man with a criminal background, a home invader, somebody that, I guess, his girlfriend called 911. That's why the cops even came. In George Floyd's case, you have a guy who's all shot up on drugs. He's got lethal amounts of fentanyl in his system, someone who's resisting arrest. With Anwar's case, you've got a law-abiding guy, a legal immigrant, driving an Uber, trying to make a living for his family, and he's mercilessly and wantonly and needlessly killed. And that's just the point. I don't see the left or the Democrats organizing 10 funerals for this guy. I don't expect a gold casket. I can predict we're not going to see Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in Pakistani outfits taking a knee or paying their devotions to this guy, Anwar. Why? Because it's not politically convenient. And so when I think about that, it sort of diminishes my concern over George Floyd. Because I recognize that this is not a case where we're sympathizing human to human. This is a case where all of this is politically motivated and orchestrated. This is a sort of drama for public consumption and for political benefit. So why should I shed fake tears over it? I'm not going to. I think we've got to recognize that if we value human life, we've got to value human life for what it is. Anwar's life matters as much as George Floyd's life. And the discrepancy in public attention to this tells you that something kind of bogus and fake is going on. Some lives evidently matter more than others. Black lives matter, or is it that black lives matter more? Black lives matter and Pakistani lives don't matter. Black lives matter and nobody else's life matters. Black lives matter and that's the only thing the media needs to cover. No, no, no. The idea here from the beginning was always very different. It was that black lives have been discounted in the past. And we emphasize that Black Lives Matter because Black Lives Matter no less, but I would add also no more than anyone else's. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you must try Genesis 950. The reviews are amazing. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength, Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the kitchen and recently got ink on her pants, and Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950, it's much cheaper than replacing your carpets. Andrew Pollock is a parent of the Parkland shooting, and his daughter Meadow tragically killed at Parkland. Andrew subsequently wrote a very moving account, a moving book called Why Meadow Died. We interviewed Andrew Pollock in my movie Trump Card, and I wanted to bring him back on the podcast because we've had 2 mass shootings, one in Atlanta, one in Boulder. I think the Parkland experience has something to say about that. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. I know that you have left Florida and moved to Oregon. Debbie was showing me some video of your ranch, which is looks like it's another world. I see all kinds of goats running around and water flowing. It looks like you decided you had enough of Florida.
Well, not so much Florida, more Broward County, Dinesh. Florida is a great state for people to live in. We're a super majority Republican. We got the number one governor in the country. But just Broward. Broward is just like a cesspool. And I just couldn't live there anymore. I couldn't be around that element where every senator, every state senator in Broward actually voted to reinstate that failed Sheriff Israel. So just the fact of that and just being in this environment, it was good for my soul to get away from it. And I moved. We moved about 2 hours north of my wife's family. They live in California. I didn't want to live in California. So we picked a rural county in Oregon, Jackson County, where we bought a ranch. And we're making a life for ourselves, trying to get some peace. And we've been accomplishing it. I'm enjoying myself out there. I raised some goats. I'm a rancher. I went from being a scrap metal entrepreneur in New York to a rancher in Oregon, you know. So it's kind of a different lifestyle, you know. My accent doesn't fit what I do, but I'm enjoying it, Dinesh. I'm liking the peace, and these Oregonians are really nice people out there that I've been meeting some really good friends I made.
That is really good to hear. Now, one of the things that I've noticed with these mass shootings is that there's an outcry immediately following them for gun control, for taking away the AR-15s or take away the guns. And I guess the basic idea is that we don't know a mechanism to identify the shooter. Because, I mean, think about it. When you confiscate the guns, you're taking guns away from all kinds of law-abiding citizens. So why would you need to do that if there was some way to identify in advance the kind of troubled personality who would do a mass shooting? But your experience from Parkland is that there are ways to identify such people. Talk a little bit about, and we covered some of this ground in Trump Card, the shooter in the Parkland case and how there was plenty of warning.
Well, I'm pretty much an expert from the wrong way, you know, because my daughter got murdered. Plus, Dinesh, my wife's an emergency medical physician. And she sees a lot of mentally ill people in the emergency room. There are laws in place that would, with due process, in Florida, we call it the Baker Act. When someone mentally ill goes to the hospital and they're put through the system, I'm talking a full due process. They see the psychiatrist. They go in front of the judge. That process, 99.9% of the time, never happens with the mentally ill. They're released back into the streets where they have no background and they're able to purchase a rifle. They took away all the mental institutions and they don't use that process of putting that on their background that they're mentally ill and dangerous. And those laws are in place. I don't think there's someone out there that would be against preventing someone who's mentally ill and dangerous from getting a rifle. And that was the case in Parkland. He threatened to kill people. He threatened to shoot the school up. He threatened raping people. And in so many of these mass shootings, we're dealing with people that are mentally ill. And in Boulder, we're gonna find that it's the same. It was the same thing in Boulder. There was the case in Colorado a while back. So these cases, the laws are in place. Republicans or Democrats aren't pushing that. Let's, you know, they're pushing background checks, but we all know background checks only work, Dinesh, if they have a background. These people, these murderers didn't have a background. They were able to purchase their rifles legally.
Let's talk about the Atlanta shooting, because while there was an effort here to say that this was a hate crime, 6 out of the 8 victims in those massage parlors were Asian American. It appears that the shooter in that case was a sort of a sexually demented sicko type. He had a fetish, or he had an anger against these massage parlors. I guess he thought they were symbols of social decay, or maybe he was fighting a part of himself. In any case, that appears to be a clear case of someone who is mentally deranged through sexual perversion, not a hate crime in the racial sense. And yet, there was a media attempt. I mean, what I'm interested here is the way in which these narratives are constructed, false narratives, in which something that is really one thing is portrayed as being another.
And when they pull these false narratives, Dinesh, it really doesn't benefit the public. You know, it's good for ratings. You know, they want people watching. But in generality, it doesn't help us. You know, they focus on that. They focus on gun control. And meanwhile, they're going to go through life with this mental illness and never get a background. And that's really what's affecting the public, you know, the mentally ill, the no institutions, no backgrounds on these people. And if we focused on that, we'd actually have some come up with some solutions, real solutions that would better protect the American people. But we're not there yet from either side. You know, I don't see Republicans. I don't see Democrats going focusing on this mental illness with the laws that are in place. Let's focus on these laws that are in place with due process and prevent these mentally ill people from getting firearms.
What I found interesting in the Boulder case was that, first of all, the guy, the assassin, was known to the FBI. He was apparently not a kind of a new face. They were well aware of him. And apparently they were well aware of him before this happened. And he was also, of course, a Muslim. He was a refugee from Syria, very political, very involved in the Syrian conflict, very anti-Trump. So it's almost like the moment the shooting happened, in fact, there were lots of people posting on social media, enough of white supremacy, we've had enough of these white guys with guns. And then the moment they realized it was a Muslim, it's like, time to delete, time to cover up your tracks. And I noticed the story has basically vanished, which tells me that, or the shift has been, okay, now that we know it's a Muslim, let's stop talking about who did it, and let's focus entirely on the gun. Another example of the way in which these narratives are malleable, and they seem to move as facts are discovered. So you get the sense here that this is, in the end, not really about public safety at all. It's about making political points. It's about blaming the right. What is your sense of where this is going? Are we even taking this issue seriously?
Well, it's, you know, the Parkland shooter, the FBI dropped the ball also in Parkland. We actually have a case moving against the FBI where they went to, they put a motion in to dismiss because of sovereign immunity. But we able to pierce that, which is huge because in life, I meet with a lot of law enforcement agencies. And after every mass shooting, if you dissect it, you could actually learn something from it. To better equip police, to better, so the public is more aware. So it's the same thing. Now the FBI dropped the ball again, and there's no one saying, you know, that all the focus is on the Second Amendment. How about the failures? You know, the failures of the FBI, the Boulder police not being able to respond so efficient. You know, they're responding like from the dinosaur age, you know, and without the cameras were in place, they're talking from a megaphone out in the parking lot. You know, there's ways to better equip the police. We got to look at these shootings, dissect them, so these things don't happen again. And it does. When you focus on the Second Amendment, just attacking it, which I think the reason is it's very simple for them to do that, Dinesh. It takes a lot of time to dissect the failures, right? To look into the FBI drop the ball, the mental illness, the response time. Why did this happen? Or it's so simply minded just to say, well, it's the gun and let's go after the Second Amendment. That's simple.
I mean, you made the very telling point in Trump card that you have become a stronger supporter of the Second Amendment for the simple reason that lots of people called 911 and yet nobody came to save your daughter.
Yep, it's true. And, you know, here you are in Colorado and I don't think there was one person concealed carry inside the store. I won't go anywhere because by the time you call 911, most of the time they're filling out a report or it's too late. You know, I urge people all the time to go out and train, get your concealed carry permit, you know, so just in case a situation like this happens, you could defend yourself. The biggest thing that happens to me when there's a mass shooting is it brings me back to my daughter being a victim on that hallway and no one there to help her. And she's cowering and she's getting shot at point blank. And that goes through my mind after every mass shooting. I think of the victims, how they were just victims in the supermarket, at that massage place, at the Kmart, at the temple. It just really sickens me what to think of these victims. And that's really what gets to me deep inside my soul when I see these mass shootings, Dinesh.
And you told me in Trump card that if the teachers or if there was someone in that building that was armed and knew how to use a gun, your daughter would be alive today.
100%. He reloaded 5 times in the building and no one was there to stop him. Only those unarmed coaches went into the building that day.
Andrew Pollack, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Really appreciate it. Maybe one of these days, Debbie and I will come drop in on you and check out those goats.
Oh, you're welcome anytime. Come on out and we'll hit some of the many vineyards.
Oh, that's an added incentive.
There you go.
Thanks very much.
Anytime, Dinesh. Have a great day.
She's one of the most powerful voices for faith, family, and freedom. Someone I respect, a friend of mine, Candace Owens. Candace has joined the powerful lineup at The Daily Wire, launching a new show where talk show meets late night. She'll continue to call out leftist lies and the corruption of the media and big tech. Join Candace each week as she welcomes powerful voices to talk about the important issues, break down what's actually happening in our country, and trust me, you're going to laugh a lot too. Candace is unfiltered and uncancelable, even as she says all the things others on the right wing are afraid to say. A full show is available to Daily Wire members only. Use code Dinesh and get 25% off your Daily Wire membership now. USA Today appears to be on a campaign to prevent the defendants of January 6th from raising money to pay for their own legal defense. I hope that this comes across to you as a shocking idea, because it is for me. It's shocking because the government in these cases has unlimited resources. I discovered this in my own case. There is no limit to what they can deploy against you. They've got a battery of lawyers. They've got a virtual infinity of FBI agents. There were like 10 assigned to my case. I mean, one was going through my tax returns, another was going through my bank statements, the third was reading all my books to see if I made incriminating statements they could use against me. So this is how these people operate. They've got an army on their side. And on the other side, you've got some of these January 6th defendants, Trumpsters. And these are people of limited means. One is a plumber, one is an electrician. These are people trying to make a living. Their families are in a panic. They are facing the loss, the destruction of their life, the loss of their freedom. They're trying to raise some money to pay for their own defense, which they have every right to do. And what is USA Today doing? These scoundrels, these thugs, they're using journalistic brown shirtism to basically go after all the sites and all the places, the crowdfunding sites, the payment processing sites, the ways in which you can raise money by appealing to the public. It's, to me, absolutely disgusting. And the perpetrator here is a young woman named Brenna Smith, who very proudly goes, "My first story for USA Today. Defendants in the January 6th Capitol riot continue to crowdfund online using popular payment processors despite a growing crackdown." Well, here's the point. It'd be one thing if Brenna Smith were to just report and say, "Hey, listen, a bunch of these defendants are doing this. They're using crowdfunding sites. Some of the crowdfunding sites won't let them do it. Others are allowing them to do it." But no, this is her sly and invidious technique. What she does is she basically finds out what are the sites that still allow these defendants to raise money. And in some cases, the sites themselves are allowed, but of course the payments have to be processed. And they're processed through places like PayPal, or Stripe. And so what the writer, Brenna Smith, does is she identifies these defendants trying to raise money, and then she calls PayPal and Stripe and says, "Hey, listen, have you canceled their accounts? Have you prevented them from being able to raise money?" And in some cases, these guys are, "Well, yeah, we have." So in order to prove that they might not have, then Brenna Smith goes, and I'm going to go through this here a little bit here. She goes, "A USA Today reporter was able to donate $10 to Big's fundraiser using Stripe to process the payment." So USA Today starts sending money through Stripe and goes, "Aha, we found out that these guys can in fact raise money." And then immediately, of course, in no time, the processor panics because they're being contacted by USA Today. "Are you supporting the insurrection? Are you supporting the riot?" And they immediately cancel that access to funding. Here's another example. Friday, a USA Today reporter donated to Pezzola's fundraising using Stripe. A USA Today reporter was able to make a $1 donation to Pezzola's fundraiser using Venmo, a payment approved by PayPal, after being alerted by USA Today. Venmo removed the account. So you can see here, this is not neutral journalism. USA Today is on a crusade to sort of identify who is raising the money. USA Today is sending its own money through the system to prove, hey, we did it. We sent the money. Now go ahead and cancel the account. So let's back up and think of what's really going on. This Brenna Smith, a budding journalist, thinks she's doing something noble. But what is she really doing? It's a horrific act. She's actively preventing people who cannot afford legal, proper legal representation when their lives and freedom are at stake. What a sickening debut for a young journalist. And of course, her seniors at the USA desk, the investigation desk, rushed to her defense. Here's Brett Murphy of USA Today. Our intern just published her first story, and this is the vitriol she is met with. Just insane. Now, first of all, this is probably the thug-in-chief that put her up to it. He probably told her to do it. She's a young reporter, I grant. Someone is steering her. Do this, do that. Oh, yeah, try to send a dollar here. Try to send $5 there. Let's prove that the money can be processed. So what you have here is a journalistic, you may say, brown shirt operation or black shirt operation. It's pure fascism. It's using the power of technology and using the power of information and public exposure to sort of intimidate these payment processing companies. From doing what? From preventing people having the means to defend themselves in court. So this basic right to self-defense and to appeal to the public. Hey, listen, I don't have the money. Can you help me? The U.S. government is after me. I certainly know that feeling. And so I sympathize with these people trying to get a proper legal defense. And I cannot tell you how disgusted I am at USA Today. This journalistic thug operation using this young journalistic twit as a tool to basically prevent people from having a defense when their own lives and freedom are at stake. There's a new movie out that I want you to see. Debbie and I saw it. We enjoyed it. It's called Church People, and it's a comedy that will leave you laughing out loud while ultimately reminding you of the true meaning of the gospel. Here's a clip. Listen.
I told you if we broke attendance records, I'd get the church logo tattooed on my arm.
Skip, remember back when we first started?
All we did was preach the gospel.
Ooh, Superman works. I like Superman.
Guy, what do you think?
What happened to you?
Me? Your dad is the one with the gimmicks.
The power of the Holy Spirit propels us.
I just want the church to get back to the gospel.
Problem is, you're trying to get your message across.
The gospel.
Right, right, right. And ain't nobody listening to that.
Oh, yeah. Watch Church People at salemnow.com. That's salemnow.com. Use my promo code Dinesh at checkout for a special discount. The left is in an uproar over the new election integrity law in Georgia, signed by Governor Kemp. And so there's a campaign to go after the two huge corporations, private corporations in Georgia, namely Coke and Delta Airlines, to lobby against the new law. These are obviously very influential. They employ a lot of people. There's a lot of money. And the left wants to recruit these corporations, these woke corporations, to get behind them and go after Georgia, try to sort of overturn, you may say, or push back on this Georgia law. Now, interestingly, so far, Delta and Coke have said, nah, we're not doing it. And so the left is trying to now organize a boycott of both Delta and Coke. Now, the boycott, which has got sort of the BLM stamp on it, first of all, these woke corporations, they've got to realize these boycotts are laughable. What, you got BLM guys who aren't going to drink Coke, they're going to be drinking Pepsi instead. What, all 8 of them, all 10 of them, big deal. This is going to have no impact on Coke's bottom line. They're not going to fly on Delta Airlines, even if it's the most convenient way to fly. Give me a break. So I don't think this is the problem right here. Now, there is a problem with these woke corporations. And part of what puzzles me here is I think if you had told me 20 years ago that, you know, the Democratic Party and the left would be like recruiting major corporations to do its bidding and to take one side politically against the other side, I would have thought this was ridiculous, impossible. No way this is going to happen. If you told me that corporations would be so politically involved that they would, in a sense, write off one half of the country, they would. I mean, this is their potential consumer base. These are potential customers. So what corporation that's trying to maximize its bottom line, just make money, do a good job, produce good stuff, why would they want to say to one half of their potential customers, I don't like you. I'm going to go after you. I'm going to prevent you from using my services. I'm going to ban you. This makes no economic sense at all. So why are these corporations even doing it? I think in a few cases, you know, you may have a Nike or you may have one or two companies, and probably a handful of them, where they are into this ideology. They believe what the left has to offer. They want to be crusaders for social justice. That's their mission. And so I can understand why someone like that who feels that way, who is on the left, would respond and be woke and implement all these sorts of cancellations and bannings and pressures. But why would Delta Airlines do it? Why would Coke do it? Well, I think the answer is this. It's twofold. The first is, and we can't discount this, it is democratic control of the organs of government. Think of it. If the Republicans control the House and the Senate, the Republicans would be in a position to hit back. Hey, guys, yeah, you want to take the other side politically? Okay, we'll teach you a lesson. So politically, it's only safe to do this when you're doing it in congruence with the ruling party. And that's partly why you've got these corporations responding to the Democrats and not to the Republicans. Second, I think even more important, the left has the power to hurt these people and the right doesn't. So what I mentioned a moment ago, that Coke isn't afraid of a boycott. That's laughable. And Delta's not afraid of a boycott either. Well, what are they afraid of? Well, they're afraid of being called racist. This is why the Democrats, by the way, in the context of Georgia, are using rhetoric like, it's the new Jim Crow, it's the Jim Crow of the 21st century. They're playing the race card because they know that corporations are terrified of the race card. They don't know how to respond to it. When they're accused of being somehow complicit with racism, they run for cover, they succumb, they submit, they give in. So the phenomenon of the woke corporation, I would say, is less a product of ideological affinity and more the product of fear. The fear of being branded, unfairly branded, of course, unfairly branded with a racial tag that they don't deserve, but they don't want anyway. And so they will pay virtually any price. If Coke and Delta succumb on this, I hope they don't, but if they do, we'll kind of know why. It's because they are more scared of the left and its power to tarnish their image than they are of anything that could come from the other side. My podcast is sponsored by Dr. Douglas Howard and his incredible team at Balance of Nature. This is important for you to know because I want you to discover what I did. I don't like the taste of broccoli. I'm not a fan of spinach. I don't like peas. But I love taking my 6 daily capsules, 3 easy to swallow, little red and 3 little green. That's it. When you take Balance of Nature, you're getting the equivalent of 10 daily servings of fruits and vegetables in capsule form. There are no trouble, there are no hassle, no weird flavors, just pennies per serving. Get vital nutrients sourced from 31 different fruits and veggies, what your body needs to feel good on the outside as well as the inside. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers will get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. Do you ever wonder if there is a basic temperamental or psychological difference between conservatives and liberals, between the left and the right? Do you ever wonder if people move left or become leftist or conservative? Because it's something about their nature that makes them that way. I was thinking about this reading a very interesting essay by the philosopher and writer Isaiah Berlin. It's called The Fox and the Hedgehog. And Berlin says, and he's actually quoting a fragment from the Greek poet Archilochus. And Archilochus says, "The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one thing." And this is a metaphor for the fact that there's a certain type that is all about kaleidoscopic variety. There's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And there's another type, which is just about a single unifying truth that pulls everything together. And Berlin's point is that human beings are either foxes or hedgehogs. Let's see what he says. He goes that the hedgehog has a single universal organizing principle in terms of which everything else is understood. The fox, on the other hand, pursues many different ends. They're kind of unrelated to each other. Foxes, their thought is scattered or diffused, moving on many different levels. It's a variety of experiences. They don't try to synthesize it into one idea. And Berlin says, and he's a literary man, so he's drawing on literary examples. He says Dante is a hedgehog. He cares about one big thing, the pursuit of moral perfection, if you will, the journey to paradise. Shakespeare is a fox, because Shakespeare has all these different characters, and he literally becomes them when he writes, so that he puts himself fully in their place. He never discloses his own views on politics or really on anything else. Plato is a hedgehog. Aristotle is a fox. Dostoevsky is a hedgehog, concerned about morality, guilt, crime, God. Pushkin, who writes about the sort of great variety of Russian experience, is a fox. And it's kind of got me thinking, you know, for me, a hedgehog is a kind of old Jewish guy in his 80s, and there's one book that gives his whole life meaning, and it's the Bible. And whenever something happens, he goes, what does the Bible have to say? What does the Torah have to say about this? And that settles the matter. That's what he cares about. He's a hedgehog. But then look at his son, this kind of professor of Romance languages at Oberlin College, and this guy is into a little bit of this and a little bit of that. He's a fox. And of course, the fox looks at the hedgehog and thinks, that old coot, he doesn't know anything. But the hedgehog looks at the fox and goes, that young guy, he knows a lot of little stuff and a little bit of this and that, but it's all flim-flam. He doesn't know the most important thing. So, my question is, who are the foxes today and who are the hedgehogs? Or in the recent past, Reagan, I would say hedgehog. Trump, fox. A little bit of a hedgehog too, but mostly I would say a fox. Trump was into a lot of different stuff. Obama, hedgehog. All about one thing. Let's take America down. That's all he cared about. Everything radiates out of that. Biden. Well, here we have a problem. Debbie's chuckling, but see, here's the problem, and that is that when we're talking about the fox and the hedgehog, we're talking about two different types of mind. Is your mind singular, unifying, synthetic, or is it broad, varied, kaleidoscopic? But see, in order to be a fox or a hedgehog, in this sense, you have to have a mind. That's the problem with Biden. But, so Biden can't play. We can't play the game with Biden. And I know Biden's going to be really annoyed. Dinesh, come on, man. You dog-faced pony soldier. I want to play. You know, I mean, the guy's going through his second child, and I go, okay, Biden, you know what? Joe, listen, little Joe, sit in the corner. I'll give you some crayons. You can play there. You can't play the fox and the hedgehog. Sorry. And then some people may say, well, what about you, Dinesh? Fox or hedgehog? Well, hedgehog. But I'm kind of a foxy hedgehog, by which I mean I am a hedgehog, but I do have a lot of varied interests, and I'm willing to go there and stay there for a while. But in the end, I do try to bring it back to the one big thing. At the end of the day, I would say I'm more hedgehog than fox. Mike Lindell is always coming up with new stuff. His website is full of more than 100 products. And his new one, slippers. Debbie and I have the pajamas, we have the robes, but we now also have the new slippers. Mike Lindell has women's and men's, moccasins and slip-ons. Debbie and I just got ours. And if you order now, you'll get 40% off with promo code Dinesh. So don't wait. Go to mypillow.com or call 800-876-0227. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Hey, I hope you're enjoying this podcast. It's really fun for me, as you can see. I have a lot of chuckles along the way. And if you're enjoying it, please hit the subscribe button and the notifications button so you'll know when the new episodes pop up. And please share it. Let other people know about it. I'm a little worried that in some places I might be shadow banned or restricted, so I'm relying on you to help me get the word out as widely as possible. So please help me to do that. I want to talk in this concluding segment about comedy. And I've always appreciated comedy. When I was at Dartmouth, we had a renegade student newspaper called the Dartmouth Review. And we used to tell the deans that taking on our paper was a bit like wrestling with a pig, because not only did it get everyone dirty, but the pig liked it. And comedy was part of our repertoire. We used it, in some cases, a little ruthlessly. In fact, I think it's some of the more insensitive attempts at comedy that I remember from those days. It's kind of funny, but the deans and the professors would often say to us, "So you guys are so sophomoric." And we'd go, "Well, yeah, but, you know, we're sophomores. What do you expect?" And so we would make all these quips. And some of them, as I say, they pushed the zone of political correctness. There was a very angry woman who kept showing up at our office and screaming at us. And finally, one kid who was at the review basically told her, she kept talking about the fact that you men do this and you men do that and we women do this and we women do that. And finally, this guy goes, he goes, "Listen, any man who thinks a woman is his intellectual equal is probably right." One time in an article, I referred to a dean, and regret this now, but at the time I thought it was funny. I said that he had a polyester tie and a rat's hair mustache. And I guess I really offended him because he wrote an angry letter saying, "Oh no, this is an inaccurate description. You know, I don't wear polyester ties and my mustache can't reasonably be likened to rat's hair." And so then I publish under his letter a correction. I go, "You know, Dean, I'm very sorry to, we made a mistake. We goofed. In fact, you have a rat's hair tie and a polyester mustache." So this was what we did. And ridicule is a powerful weapon. It's not just the logical refutation, but often the derision that follows it that becomes a way. And particularly now, when you feel politically ganged up on, you're in the minority, you feel like, "I can't do a lot about this or that. What can I do about cancel culture?" Well, effectively deployed, ridicule can be a deadly weapon. And we live at a time when a lot of comedy has been snuffed out, strangled by political correctness. And therefore, when I see little glimpses of comedy that work, that I think do the job, and that actually reflect thought. This isn't just gratuitous insult. It's comedy with a point. And I just notice a couple of clips put out by Ryan Long. This is Ryan Long. His Twitter is at Ryan Long Comedy. And here's a clip of two guys who are apparently Antifa, but they also do something else. Check it out.
"Hi, I'm Don.
And I'm Ron, and we are members of Antifa. But what you don't know is that we're also the founders of
Not Antifa Window Repair.
If you ever need window repair, I got a bit of a suspicion you will, so.
We realized that by living this double life, we were able to create the demand for our own services.
We organize and cause riots, which then cause damage that creates customers.
Then we take our costumes off, Clark Kent style, and show up first on the scene to get the business.
Some bad people out there, so.
Yeah. Stuff happens, stuff's going to happen. Capitalism by day, communism by night."
Yeah, so this is very effective. Why? Because it actually captures not only the ideology, but the opportunism, the political opportunity that goes hand in hand with the ideology. It captures the idea, I think, and it makes fun of Antifa. It doesn't take these goons too seriously, because we're thinking, "Oh, Antifa, these people are terrifying. They appear in, you know, black shirt outfits and so on." Yeah, that's one aspect of it. But we also got to realize, if you take a good look at them, many of these people are like creatures of the night. I mean, they are, no wonder they appear in masks. You can't look at them. Otherwise, people would be crossing the street. Kids would be shrieking and so on. So these are actually comic figures. They're out of a cartoon. And I think the comedy takes note of that. Here's another clip, by the way, also from Ryan Long Comedy. This one has to do with, a very profound point, which is that there is a little bit of a similarity between the woke people and the racist people. Listen.
When me and Brad first met, I didn't think we'd get along, but turns out we kind of agree on everything.
Your racial identity is the most important thing. Everything should be looked at through the lens of race.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Damn.
We both have a lot of opinions about people of color, even though we barely know any.
I say colored people, but as long as we're classifying them. We both think minorities are a united group who think the same and act the same.
And vote the same. You don't want to lose your black card.
Sorry, I don't know. I just think we should roll back
discrimination law so we can hire based on race again.
Jinx, now you owe me a Coke.
And that's only the half of it. You should check out Ryan Long's comedy because he elaborates the point that there's deep similarities between the old racists who were all about race mattering and race should be the basis of decision making and pay attention to race and be aware of your race and treat other people based on race. And I've just given you a short summary of woke ideology. It's exactly the same. So he dramatizes it by showing the woke guy and the racist guy, and they're speaking, in a sense, in one voice. Why? Because their philosophy isn't just similar. It's identical.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. Or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.